I'm going to give a somewhat brief review of all the excitement about BICEP 2 and gravitational waves. I'll get to that, believe me. Inflation, alternatives to inflation, VSL cosmology, and then the electromagnetic origin using QED for bigger, greater speed of light, and the quantum gravity origin of greater speed of gravitational waves in the very early universe. Primordial fluctuations in gravitational waves, and draw some conclusions. This is a wonderful photograph, picture of the BICEP 2 telescope. And we have the Keck array and the BICEP 2 telescope side by side. It's a very cold place to do experimental physics. And this is our standard picture of cosmology, so-called. And something very remarkable has to happen there at the beginning. In fact, something quite exotic has to happen in order to solve the so-called initial value problem of cosmology. And we'll get to an explanation about that. It's remarkable that since I was a student, which is a long time ago, cosmology has become a science with a large amount of data that has to be explained. And here am I standing, thinking that I can explain the beginning of the universe. This is probably the ultimate hubris. However, we can speculate, and speculations have to fit the large amount of cosmological data now available. Okay, so this is what we're talking about. This is the CMB, roughly 400,000 years after the Big Bang, the T equal to zero. And there are these smudges that we have to explain, imprints on the CMB surface of last scattering. And we have, as the universe expands to the present day, development of structure. And one of the issues in cosmology is to explain how that structure came about, galaxies and clusters of galaxies and so on. So just a few words about the primordial perturbations before I get into the details. The original inflation models, all the time since famous workshop in Cambridge, the Nuffield workshop, 82, 83, where a lot of the issues of structure growth were first developed. The idea is that you have these small, tiny, these tiny quantum fluctuations sub-horizon, a very early universe, and you have this exponential inflation, and it stretches these tiny fluctuations. So they leave an imprint on the surface of last scattering, the CMB. Also, from inflation, you can predict, you will predict primordial gravitational waves are also stretched by space-time being stretched exponentially. And there's a possibility in inflation to see these primordial gravitational fluctuations, which originate very just fractions of seconds after the Big Bang at T equal to zero. Now, This is the controversial picture. It comes from the paper by the BICEP 2 collaboration. And here's the archive number. It's not yet published. I'm sure there's a lot of controversy regarding the refereeing of this paper. And it's not published yet. So it's been submitted, I believe. All right. So the what you have here is the angular power spectrum versus the multipoles, the Ls, and you have this bump. And the bump represents an excess of B polarization. And this is the data and the prediction from inflationary model. It's remarkable that they can do this experiment because the measurements are at nanokelvin temperatures. It's amazing. And nanokelvin temperature, Kelvin temperatures compared to the scalar matter power spectrum measurements, which of course, as we'll see, have been established by Planck mission. And if you look at this data, everything occurs of interest around a multiple of 100. Neil Turok has said in a public lecture in Winnipeg, which I attended just a couple, 3 weeks ago, that this data looks suspicious because there's very little statistical scatter on the central point. So, however, this is what they presented. So, we have, I'll get around to explaining the significance of this. We have earlier measurements, and WMAP, of course, Boomerang, CBI, DASI, and you can see that the bounds on the amplitude of gravitational waves is, of course, quite significantly higher than the result from BICEP 2. This is the lensing, and this is not the lensing here is not supposed to be significant around this L value of 100 or so. And to get into the details, the BICEP 2 experiment was done at one frequency, 150 gigahertz, one frequency. And this is the result they have, that the ratio of tensor to scalar, gravitational to density perturbations, matter density perturbations, is 0.2, which turns out to be quite high, much more than expected. So what's happening is that you have light being transmitted from the CMB, and you have two kinds of polarization, temperature and polarization signatures. One is the E mode, and it's radially, sticks out radially. This is parity even, like the electric field. And then you have this twirly image, it's called the B mode. This is parity negative. And it's equivalent to the curl, a non-zero curl of magnetic fields. So this is what we're looking for. This is the signal in the given in their paper. Declination is the ordinate. The abscissa is the right ascension in degrees. And you can actually see these non-curl, these twirly this Twiley signature of the B modes, which is supposed to be the detection of gravitational waves from very early universe, 10 to the minus 43 seconds, Planck time. Well, very early, okay. I'll get to numbers. Yeah. Well, if they're correct, this is one of the most important discoveries in modern cosmology, because we're getting information from the very early universe near t equal to zero, and we can't do that with electromagnetic waves because of the surface of last scattering. There's a veil 380,000 years after the Big Bang, and this veil is caused by electron-photon interactions, and after the CMB, the photons cease to interact with the protons, electrons, and we see light from that surface. But from the gravitational waves, we can get information from the early universe. Yeah.
It just strikes me that this is a little bit too much like a framed photo, and that all of the interesting structure is nicely centered in the region yeah. around the outside, which presumably has.
It's centered around 1 degree, actually, the experiment.
If I look to the left or the right of the image here, I'm not seeing the same level of
no,
structure.
That's right.
I think it's the antenna sensitivity.
Well, we'll get to that. So this is the famous microwave background from Planck and from many instruments. They're all listed here. And we're trying to explain these little smudges. And these are supposed to be the stretched fluctuations from sub-horizon early universe. Okay, so let's get to it. This is the controversy. This is a picture from the BICEP 2 paper collaboration. And this is what they present as the dust. And there are two particular model dust models that they used, DDM1 and DDM2. They didn't have foreground data from Planck. They asked twice to have the data from the Planck collaboration, and both times they said no. So they scraped the data, so-called, this is a new expression in experimental physics. They scraped the data from keynote talks. S-Lab was a conference held a year before the announcement by BICEP to Harvard, March 15th. And in that S-Lab conference, there were talks by Omong and others. And they took the data, digitized it off those slides. A somewhat dangerous activity experimentally. Okay. Anyway, the problem is that the result for dust is model dependent. We're using models. Okay, so this is from one of the this is a foreground, dust foreground map from Planck presented by Bernard at the S-Lab meeting. And this is actually a map of the dust. And here you see zero for blue and red is 0.2% from zero to 20%. And this P means the probability of seeing dust. It's a polarization dust factor, P, the probability of seeing polarization dust. Okay. Now, it says up there, not CIB subtracted. CIB means cosmic infrared background. This is non-B. This is dust. This is emission coming in from galaxies, the Milky Way, from distant galaxies, which is not B-polarized swirly. So you have to subtract that out if you're looking for B-polarization signals. And they took this off this the CIP2 took this off his keynote slide, and they didn't subtract this. And this CIB comes into the eye, which is the intensity of polarization. So when you subtract it, I goes down and P goes up. So if you do that, the contention is from people who have looked at this subsequently that Q squared and U squared are the pixel measurements from Planck for the dust. And when if you go to 8% from 5% is the amount of dust contamination coated by BICEP2 collaboration. If you go up to 8-10%, dust can explain the whole signal. That is the problem. Now, recently, Planck mission updated this data, dust data, and in here, around here, you can have places where, as you can see from the colors, you can have considerable dust, 20%, which would completely obliterate the primordial gravitational wave signal. Unfortunately, they blanked out the place where you have 150 gigahertz frequency BICEP2 measurement. And the reason given was not because they're malicious and very competitive, but because the resolution here is not good. Unfortunate. The rumor is in October, Planck will finally release their dust polarization maps. And hopefully we'll know. I was in Paris visiting the Institut d'Astrophysique de Paris, IAP. This is where the Planck mission people are located in Europe. And I had talks with them, and they weren't optimistic about the prospect of deciding this issue because of the issue of systematic errors and the resolution involved in these measurements. Anyway, in the meantime, in Princeton, Raphael Flager, who is at the Institute for Advanced Study and a collaborator, did intensive work trying to understand the foreground dust problem using digitized data from keynote talks from SLAB, like the BICEP2 people. And this is what they found. They found that there's a dust, the dust can mask the bump that I showed you earlier and just obliterate it. And therefore, the claim is that we haven't seen relic gravitational waves, just the dust in my shoes.
So those bands are what?
The bands are the dust result. Foreground contamination by dust. What happens is that the dust, these are tiny grains of dust interstellar, and they spin in magnetic field of the interstellar space and galaxies, the Milky Way. They absorb light, but they also reflect the light. And reflected light looks like it is B polarization signal. It's the same.
So the first two masks.
Well,
but the part that it doesn't mask is not the data.
This is with lensing. You have to include lensing, by the way. And this one.
Dust can explain all the data.
This one.
Lensing or dust alone.
There are two ways of doing this. One is to look at the columns of hydrogen, 21 centimeter neutral hydrogen. And that's what NH1 is. And you see light coming through from CMB. It runs through these columns of hydrogen, and you see bipolarization, contamination. Okay, so the bottom line is that, this is also controversial because they're extrapolating the... What you have is B polarization, and you have gigahertz. And this is what it looks like. It's a parallel, and this is dust. It peaks at around 400 gigahertz, and it has a minimum around 100. And this is where BICEP 2 did it. So the reason they chose 150 gigahertz for the frequency at which they did their measurement is because it is in the low dust region. And what these people are doing is taking Planck at 353 gigahertz and extrapolating down to there using scraped off data from keynote talks. Therefore, don't take this as the last word. In the meantime, Mortensen and Celiac have come out with a preprint, and so also Flager, Hill, and Spergel from Princeton. And they looked at the R, the ratio of scalar to tensor, versus the scalar perturbation tilt or spectral index, which we know from Planck is 0.9603 plus or minus a small error. And you can see here what happens to inflation models. The 0.2 is very high. Inflation models, the simple ones, are not happy about the R is 0.2. And the purple is Planck plus WMAP plus BICEP 2. And this is what the R is favored by simple inflation models like Linder's phi squared. And N is the number of e-folds. So however, as we'll get to inflation, we'll find out that inflation can predict just about anything. So you pull the potential off the shelf, take its derivatives, and you fit the data. No big deal. Okay, so we wait for Planck South Telescope, South Pole Telescope, Polar Bear, Actor Pole, Keck Array, and all the other data, balloon data. And within a year or two, what we want is to have measurements at different frequencies. And the gravitational wave signal looks like this as a parallel. So you have this gap. So if you know the frequency dependence, this will settle the issue. So if by chance there's a dust hole down there at 1 degree, down in the football at the BICEP 2 location, if there's a dust hole, they get the Nobel Prize. If there isn't a dust hole and there's a lot of dust, say 28 to 20%, they don't get the Nobel Prize. This is why it pays to be risky in putting out papers like this, because you're the first to do it, okay? If it turns out you're right, you get the Nobel Prize, because you say, we were the first to do it. When I talked to the Planck people, I said, well, this was the first time I talked to them. And this was the excitement just some days after April 1st, 2nd. I said, well, you know, it's an amazing result, the Nobel Prize for the BICEP2 collaboration. And they jumped up and said, no, we're going to get the Nobel Prize, not them. So I thought, aha, the hunt for the Nobel Prize is on again. Now, inflation, let me move on. First pros for inflation. There's so much published about inflation since 1980, Guth, Linder, 82, Steinhardt, and Albrecht, and Steinhardt, 82, 83. Textbooks, graduate courses, you know, you really believe it's true, okay? Enormous media hype. So if you, these are the pros. If you're given initial conditions for inflation, and then it has three key features. Horizon problem is solved. Uniformity of the CMB Planck temperature spectrum is explained. All points communicate with one another causally. The flatness problem is solved to within the 1 or 2% from what we know from Planck mission. In particular, three, the wavelengths of tiny quantum seeds of matter fluctuations in gravitational waves are stretched by inflation to large values. The initial, the final wavelength is stretched exponentially. Inflation produces an almost scale invariant adiabatic Gaussian spectrum. This is good. It fits the data. This is the roll, the slow roll. Original model by Guth didn't work because he had this ball tunneling through here, right to the true vacuum, right through there. But it turned out that when you did that, there was no matter in the universe at all. It was an empty universe, so that didn't work. So Steinhardt and Albrecht and Linder produced this model, which is a false vacuum. It's slowed down. The roll down here is very slow. It's a flat potential, so you get enough E folds of expansion. This is from the Planck paper, 2013, and it shows what happens to inflation models. And these are simple models. The power law inflation is not favored, and there are problems with, as we saw earlier, tensor to scalar ratio versus the primordial tilt tensor S. It doesn't look great. But cons for inflation. This is longer than pros. So the initial conditions of the universe are not natural for inflation models to produce enough inflation, 60 E folds. Gibbons and Turok showed that the probability of producing inflation phase is exponentially small. In fact, they found that for the model V of phi equal to 1/2 m squared phi squared, that the probability was for n e folds is equal to exponential minus 3 n, where n is of order 10 to the 27. That's it. 60 E folds. It got worse, but they sharpened it up and they arrived at the result that the probability is. N is the number of E folds. Okay, it's in their paper, Physical Review. Penrose made similar statements. Paper in National Academy of Sciences in 1985 using thermodynamics and entropy arguments. Same thing. The choice of potential for influent field are many. And you can fit the data cosmologically, they can be fitted by some potential in its derivatives. This was, the paper was put out in 2013-14 by Ilya Steinhardt and Loeb. He gave a colloquium here last year, listing all the problems with inflation. the significant fine-tuning of parameters. To get delta T over T 10 to the minus 5, you need to fine-tune all inflation models to 1 part 10 to the 15. This is bad. Okay? It doesn't falsify inflation. It just makes you feel that something is really not working very well. The naturalist problem is becoming a serious problem in physics, modern physics. We have three major naturalist problems. We have the Higgs problem. The Higgs mass is in bad shape when you actually calculate, when you calculate the self-energy for the Higgs for the scalar potential, scalar field from the first order loop is quadratically divergent. So it doesn't look very, the fine tuning is very bad. There's also a gauge hierarchy problem in the standard model. Why is the Planck mass so much bigger than the electroweak scale 246 TeV? This is if the Higgs is an elementary particle. I'm going to give a talk in the near future about this issue, because I have a model which I claim that gets rid of all this naturalist problem, fits the data. Anyway, that's another talk. The other terrible naturalist problem is the cosmological constant problem. And as we all know, if you calculate the cosmological constant from loops, it's quartically divergent. So there's an enormous discrepancy with for observation.
Is the least of our problems inflationary fine-tuning? Because all the other ones are much worse.
Okay, I like the way you quantify it. You think this is more than I can stomach. Well, okay. Maybe it's less than, I mean, it's all a personal issue. Oh, we're not done. So what happens is that when the inflation is happening, ignoring this thing about the measure, then different pockets in the space-time are inflating at different levels. And some are inflating not fast enough. And when you want inflation, you need rho equals 1/2 phi dot squared A phi, and P equals 1/2 phi dot squared minus V phi. To get inflation, you need P of order minus rho. And this means that 1/2 phi dot squared has to be much less than V phi. So there are pockets of space-time that don't want to do this. And they cause a non-uniformity as the space starts expanding, space-time expands, and defeats the original prediction of inflation that it gets rid of the inhomogeneity as the inflation happens. This produces, so how do you get out of this? Because we're in four-dimensional space-time. We can't have this huge non-uniformity happening as the universe is expanding. So you say, oh, these pockets are different universes. Multiverse. This is how you get out of the trap. There's been arguments about this. I call it the multiverse war. It's happening right now. And the multiverse war.
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 Oh, I think
it
said war.
La guerre.
As in
French.
Fight.
Right. Ah,
dangerous.
Good idea.
But John,
you should let them credit.
Yeah. Just to get to at least the fourth point, I'm not, this is probably a lunch discussion, but I'm not at all convinced that you're going to be able to get internal inflation without fine tuning, as long as you use spec laws.
Oh, I agree. We're not even into whether there's so much fine tuning going on inflation models, you get completely tangled up in it, okay? Which do you, are you going to worry about?
So a ridiculous fine-tune, that is, unless you do a fine-tuned potential with very, very long, with very finely tuned false metastable vacua, which you could argue about too, I would say I don't think this can happen.
Well, I don't know which side you want to join with the multiverse issue, but anyway.
Well, you're making me defund inflation in some sense, which is
okay.
Odd, but
no problem. Multiverse, Scientific American 2011. I like these pictures. You can see from the beginning of inflation, we get all these different universes. Now, in Nature, the 3rd of June, Steinhardt came out with another article, and I'm quoting from it. Some proponents of inflation who celebrated the BICEP 2 announcement already insist that the theories equally value whether or not gravitational waves are detected. How is this possible? Scanning over all possible bubbles in the multiverse, everything that can physically happen does happen an infinite number of times. No experiment can rule out a theory that allows for all possible outcomes. Hence, the paradigm inflation is unfalsifiable. Taking this into account, it's clear that the inflation paradigm is fundamentally untestable and hence scientifically meaningless. This is Nature, okay? The referee actually accepted this. Good. Alternatives to inflation. That's a possibility. I'm not trying to defend him. I'm just showing, let's not forget that Paul Steinhardt was the originator of the first model that worked for inflation, 1982-83. It was called the New Model of Inflation. Now, what about alternatives? Well, if we're complaining about inflation, well, you can't just do that in physics. You have to go out and do something about it and produce a model that works without all this fine-tuning and so forth. This is not easy, okay? However, there are competing models. There's the ekpyrotic model, Khoury over at Steinhardt and Turok. There are bouncing models, which avoid singularity to t equal to zero, Brandenburger, Eason, Peter, others. Hybrid bouncing ekpyrotic models, Brandenburger et al. Patrick Peter in Paris just put out a big review paper on bouncing models, which looks quite interesting, actually. The pros and cons. There are a lot of cons, which I don't have time to get into. String cosmology, string gas cosmology. Variable speed of light cosmology, me, okay. 92, 93, Albrecht and Magejo, Clayton and myself, and lots of others. Any alternative model must satisfy the key requirements. One, it solves the horizon flatness problems. Two, a mechanism exists to stretch initial primordial quantum matter fluctuations and gravitational waves to super horizon scales. That's not easy. The fluctuations must be almost scale invariant, adiabatic, and Gaussian. Three, if the BICEP 2 discovery of B-mode relic gravitational waves is confirmed, then the model must produce a large enough amplitude for gravitational waves in the CMB. These are things you have to get in the alternative. Okay, let's get to me. So, after BICEP 2, I thought, well, I was about to go to Paris until my visit to the IEP. And I thought, well, let's go and revisit VSL 22 years later. And I've done some work on it since 92, 93 with the so-called biometric gravity model. But by the way, the biometric gravity model doesn't work because it means that gravitational waves will move slower than the speed of light. So you can never get an amplitude large enough to explain the potential BICEP 2 result. Okay, so this is revisit of my model from then, somewhat revamped. It's called putting old wine in new bottles, okay? And this is my action. Kappa is C naught is the present speed of light. And this is a constant throughout the evolution of the universe in here. And this is, I need to spontaneously violate Lorentz invariance in the early universe when my speed of light is large. Otherwise, I can't explain special relativity and causality and so on. So this is the action that does the spontaneous violation of Lorentz invariance. I first published this at the time when I published these papers on my VSL, 92, 93. And this is my seed field, scalar seed field. It's a simple non-minimal couple scalar field. So the basic premise is that in the very early universe, for a short duration of time, C is much greater than C naught, and the gravitational wave speed is much greater than C naught, present value speed of light.
With the exception of J, all these others are, all the rest of these terms are fairly standard.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. So this is the energy momentum tensor. I do a variation on the field variables. I get these three equations, of course. And the energy momentum is conserved. And I choose a Mexican hat for the W potential to get spontaneous violation of Lorentz invariance. This is also discussed by Kostelecki, Potting, and Bloom and Kostelecki, and more recently by Bloom in a review paper. And mu and lambda are positive. We have a minimum at this value. When the vector field has a non-zero vacuum expectation value, it breaks Lorentz invariance compared to the vacuum expectation value with scalar field, which doesn't, of course, because directions are broken up. So I choose a time-like vector in my Mexican hat. That's the direction of time. And this is given here. And the Lorentz group SO3,1 is broken down to the spatial rotation group and so forth. The spontaneous breaking of the Lorentz diffeomorphic symmetries produces massless Nabokov-Stone modes. This is all familiar, and massive particle modes. This is discussed in a lengthy paper by Bloom and Kostelecki in 2005. So gravitons get a mass during this time. Okay. And okay, so now I identify my unit vector spontaneous symmetry breaking, which pulls out a preferred time. And this preferred time corresponds to, I assume, to FRW. LFRW has this symmetry, O3 cross R. R is the preferred time. And I have the energy momentum tensor described by perfect fluid. Usual picture for isotropic homogeneous cosmology. So the horizon problem is trivially solved because when you calculate the horizon length, if C is very large, C goes to infinity, then dH goes to infinity, and all points in the expanding spacetime for t less than tc. Tc is the dividing time between having a large c and not having a large c.
How does c become time-dependent? So what's the
I'm going to get to that.
But it must be something in the order dimension, right?
Well,
you've already said what the action is. So.
Yeah. In there, I scale anything to do with dt squared, I scale it with c as a function of t. The action, in the action, well, I'll get to that now. Because of the scaling in dt squared, when I get to the Friedman equations, 1 over c squared, 1 over the t squared, I have 1 over c squared dA by dt. This is squared, this is h squared, divided by a. Square. This is the assumption that goes into this. It's a simple assumption.
The assumption is that you've got, when you've broken the symmetry, so you've got this vector field, you're choosing that vector field to define the preferred time for you.
But everything you describe in words must already be in your equation. It must be in the action because everything follows from the action. So I'm just wondering.
So it's in the very
W.
Yeah.
W is C.
W is the potential, spontaneous symmetry breaking potential. You're pulling out a preferred proper core moving time.
But then there's no coupling to matter. So you want either matter or gravity.
Another attempt I did in Paris was to take the C inside. This is SG, my gravitational action. And this was also suggested by Albrecht and McGinty, who published a paper some years after me, 1999. But then you have a Branch Dickey type action now. Okay. And psi is equal to C. And so you do the variation, you get complicated equations. Albrecht McGager's paper is wrong because they didn't do the variation principle correctly, as pointed out by George Ellis. However, I'm going for a simpler, I want to keep things simple at the moment, phenomenologically speaking. Okay. So I'm going for this simpler assumption. Now, flatness problem. So,
their model, but it's C. You didn't say, but it's C in your model. Which field is the speed of light in your model?
He doesn't want to tell us yet, I think.
Well, no, I mean, it's...
According to Martin, it's double. It's fine.
Well, W is the potential that gives you the...
W is a proportion of the vector field, but there is no coupling to the matter, so...
I'm giving you matches to the vector field is going to make the speed of light go up.
Yeah, how are those two related?
It's the dynamical scaling of the proper time, dt. Everywhere you have a dt, you have a c.
How does that follow from the action?
It doesn't follow. It's an assumption I put in to the actual derivation of the field equation.
So you're saying that in the action there we have g mu nu, you put c explicitly and you consider the dynamical.
That's right. There's an alternative, of course, which I worked out, but it gets very complicated. Anyway, so flatness problem is solved because this is what you get for the final value of omega naught. Omega is the usual rho over rho critical. And if C naught equals C in the standard cosmology, then as shown by Mukhanov, if A naught dot is larger than AI dot, there's an acceleration, the universe is accelerating after its initial phase, then omega naught is an attractor, it's driven towards one. For me, CI is bigger than C naught. The initial value of C is bigger than the final value, of course. And this drives omega to one to a high degree of accuracy. So it's a very simple solution to the flatness problem.
So, I guess I still don't have that point. So it seems that what you're describing is just metric. So I mean if the only place that C appears is in
the Friedman equations. Hmm? It appears in the Friedman equations.
In the action, if you just all you're doing is you write your metric as C squared, dt squared, then that's just D00 component. The Z 0-0 component metric. So, and we know, I mean, GR is a gauge of a deep invariant theory. So, I mean, G0-0 is the change depending on your definition of time. So, so I don't see how that's a physical form. If that's the only place that C appears.
It's very simple assumption. Wherever there's a dt,
yeah,
it's descaled by a larger c. It's,
but
a, the,
but that's
it's,
already
it's the absolute simplest
for
thing I can
theory,
do.
There's already a g00 that sits there. Right? So
yeah,
wherever there's a dt, there's a g00.
Where is the dynamical content related to c? I think that's the question.
Yeah.
Where is the
yeah
dynamical part that makes
well, that's coming.
Okay.
Well, so, so now I assume that v is zero in my scalar field action, and for the seed field, and I solve, this is the equation I get. And this has this solution. And when I go back to my Friedman equation, this is what I have. And I finally end up with this solution for the cosmic scale. Yeah, this plays an important role later on. This is when C equals C naught after the stretching of the waves has happened. Phi dot is dominant in the early universe. It goes like 1 over 8 cubed according to the solution I just have. So there are no observable effects in the present universe. So now I come to trying to explain where, what would be the origin of a varying C, except other than just assuming it. So I go to a paper by Drummond and Hathrow, Physical Review, 1980. And they generalized Maxwell's equations and applied it to an FLRW spacetime. And it leads to a varying speed of light from QFT. They showed that the photons propagate at speed faster than C naught when vacuum polarization in QED acts as a dispersion medium in the presence of tidal gravitational forces with a refractive index and refractor. This is the electromagnetic Lagrangian. These are the, these, this is all scale invariant. It comes from a paper by Deser and Neuwenhuysen, 1974. And these are the, these two are the minimal coupled, coupling to the electric, of the electric field to curvature. And these are non-minimal, these three. The A mu is potential, J mu is the action. The kappa, chi, omega, zeta are constant coefficients. So Drummond and Hathrow derived this result using the Friedman equations. And K is the momentum of the photon. Normally, K squared is zero. But when you put in a non-minimal electromagnetic coupling, you get a non-zero K squared. So you modify the dispersion relation for photons. You put in all the numbers that they got. Alpha is the fine structure constant. Lambda is the Compton wavelength of the electron. This is the answer you get. C equals 1 minus 11 over 2 T star over T squared to the minus a half C naught. C naught is the presently measured speed of light. And T star, the value is 6.6 times 10 to the minus 24 seconds, about 10 to the minus 23 seconds. So when T approaches T star, C becomes infinite, or very large. When C, T is less than, is greater than T star, then C becomes imaginary, so the approximation has failed. Okay? The effect of Lagrangian for gravity has failed. So this occurs for T of order 1.5 to 10 to the minus 23 seconds. This corresponds to an energy of 2 times 10 to the 5 TeV. The maximum energy for LHC of 14 TeV corresponds to 4 times 10 to the minus 15 seconds after the Big Bang. This is interesting, by the way, that 14 TeV gets you this close to T equal to zero, but not close enough. Okay. Now, gravity.
Don't we know that Lagrangian is sick?
This is the Lagrangian four.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we know that's sick. I'm pretty sure we know that's sick, that the vial tensor is the only thing you can couple to Riemann without getting into Ostrogoffsky.
It's non-minimal. And also, by the way, there have been lots of papers published about this by Graham Shaw, University of Swansea in Wales, and collaborators ever since over several years, actually. And
I understand the chain of reasoning for there. You start with this Einstein plus this vector field thing with the W potential plus the scalar thing. You derive the equations as the usual way, and then you take those equations and pretend C is variable.
That's
and
right.
Then you see what happens.
This is the simplest thing
then
to do.
Then the next step is you're going to argue that if you would use this Lagrangian, it would give you the same equations with the variable C.
That's
for
right.
This reason.
Yep.
And then you're saying the problem, Keith is saying the problem with that thing is that it has what negative energy morphologies.
Well, but then this is an effective Lagrangian.
Yeah, I know, I'm just saying, this is my understanding.
You have to distinguish between effective Lagrangians and fundamental Lagrangians. This is not pretending to be the fundamental Lagrangian of physics.
Well, as long as we're in a regime where those are not going to be important.
That's right. And that regime is the curvature less than m Planck squared. Like those corrections at Kaparov and so on. So.
Well, I mean, I think if he wants the speed up sound or light to be very different from the speed up diagonal, then probably you are.
That's right. That's another story. That Lagrangian is legit, and the argument is legit as long as you don't.
As long as they're not important, as long as they're more or less perturbative, then okay, fine.
But see, it could
but
be
if
a
they
tenth,
are important, then
it could be a
thing.
That ratio could
presumably.
Be a tenth, and it'd be okay.
Well, I would say it's at least presumptively sick, and if you want to say this makes sense, this
I think you probably true. Want those to be like 25 orders of magnitude bigger than that. So I don't think it's a because that if you want a solid problem that inflation solve, you want those terms to be 25 orders of magnitude bigger than the.
Yeah.
Now,
so I put out a paper in the archive a couple of days ago called Superluminal Gravitational Waves. So I do the same thing with gravity. I couple gravity non-minimally to R mu nu and the Riemann curvature tensor. And you get a non-zero value for K squared for gravitons. And you go through, you find that gravitons do not move along null geodesics anymore. You get two metrics. What you get from quantum gravity vacuum polarization calculations in terms of the fine structure constant, which is here for some given m. When m is of order the Planck mass, alpha g is of order 1. And so the refractive dispersive medium due to the non-minimal gravitational coupling gives rise to this result for the gravitational speed, the speed of gravitational waves. Cg0 is the present speed of gravitational waves. All of this happens 10 to the minus 40 whatever seconds after the Big Bang. Very short duration, like inflation. Inflation happens in a very short time duration. When I put out the paper for the morning it was posted, I got an email, of course, immediately from Stanley Deza saying it's an elementary fact that if you couple to Riemann tensor, higher derivative coupling, you get ghosts. It's called the Ostrogoffsky theorem. But this is an effective gravitational Lagrangian. It's not meant to be fundamental. We don't know what the fundamental Lagrangian is.
Do you know what the cutoff that I'm thinking that it seems that you're applying it beyond the cutoff of the theory?
Well, I'm expanding this formula here. I'm expanding in the perturbation theories in the fine structure constant for gravity. And I'm not expanding around CG naught. So this requires a more investigation. Namely, how is this formula, as t approaches zeta j, how is this formula linked to the perturbation calculation in the fine structure constant? There's a difference, okay? It's not clear yet. If there is a linkage, then this could be a problem. If there isn't, then it's fine.
No, but
the
concept of the effective theory is when t is
zero. It's an effective theory, okay. Yeah, because if t is bigger than bigger than zeta g, then c is complex. The whole thing fails.
No, you can't even trust that formula.
Well, this is something I'm investigating. I'm not convinced of this yet. As I said at the beginning of my talk, something remarkable has to happen near t equal to zero to get this business to work. In the case of inflation, you need to violate all the positive energy conditions, or some of them, to get P equal to minus rho, vacuum density. And the vacuum density is 10 to the power 18, I think. It's huge. So you think it's something exotic has to happen. Okay. Now, let's get to the primordial fluctuations quickly. In the inflation model, the wavelengths of the fluctuations are stretched because you have a de Sitter expansion. For me, the wavelengths are stretched because I have this simple optics formula. That C is very large, wavelengths get stretched. What happens is that the wavelengths get stretched, so they leave an imprint super horizon on the CMB. They have to be big to be seen. They start very small to begin with. And at the horizon crossing, the speed of light, last speed of light, is already over. So C is equal to its measured speed now, C naught, and you calculate the power spectrum. So let's do that. So I take my equation. I take V equal to zero in contrast to inflation. Inflation, everything depends on the slow roll potential. So you need a V and this first and second derivatives. Here, I take V equal to zero. I have this differential equation. And this is the Fourier transform. I put in the original solutions I found for A and H for phi dot dominant. And I get this equation, and this by Maple has this Bessel function solution. Here, y is going to zero. Y is given here because you're going outside the horizon. So y is going to zero. And we know that j naught goes to 1 as y goes to 0, and y naught has a logarithmic derivative as y goes to 0. So I start off by this normalized plane wave solution, and the omega k is given here, and I end up when I match the first, the plane wave solution to its first derivative, time derivative in itself, to the Bessel function solution. And I get this answer for delta phi k, the fluctuations. LP length is the Planck length. And this is the power spectrum I get. This is the Planck length. And I have this logarithmic factor here. So the power spectrum is scale invariant except for this logarithmic factor. And this is the curvature power spectrum here. And this is the answer. I calculate the tilt, the scalar tilt, and I get this answer here. And this is the running of the tilt. And this is the result I get for the amplitude. If L naught is the place in the at the crossing of super horizon, particular length that I choose, volume L naught cubed, and when I have this result, then I get this answer 0.96. I choose, okay, so I can fit the amplitude delta t over t 10 to the minus 5 without fine tuning. In inflation, it has to be fine tuned by 1 part in 10 to the 15, as I mentioned earlier, to get this correct value for the amplitude. Okay, so good. This is an agreement with Planck. Notice that I didn't have to use a potential in its derivatives. So there isn't all this fine-tuning happening in my calculation of the power spectrum and the fluctuation tilts, as in the case of inflation. Now let's get quickly to the gravitational wave fluctuations, where you can express the gravitational waves in weak field approximation. This was all done way back in 92 and 93 by people like Andrew Little and Leith. And you have 2 degrees of polarization. They're scalar, so you get a similar equation for the gravitational wave fluctuations. And you solve it in a similar way with a Bessel function solution as I did before. And this is what I get. And it's scale invariant except for this additional logarithmic factor. So when I work out the tensor tilt, I get minus 0.04. Okay. Now, this tilt is red and small. There are lots of inflation models which give a blue tilt for the tensor spectral index. So NT is something like 1.3, maybe positive, blue tilt. Okay. Now, if you adopt the BICEP2 result, namely for zero or small dust foreground, and I take the ratio of NT to R, I get minus 5, which is close to the single field inflation consistency condition, which is minus 8. This is a mistake. This should be R over NT. It's a misprint thing. So that's it. This is the predictions of the model. Yeso Kia, who is with Brandenburger at McGill, has looked into the next phase of these calculations. These are non-linear perturbation calculations. So you take the power spectra and you calculate them to a higher order. And this determines the amount of non-Gaussianity in the models. And his preliminary investigation has shown that, from my results for the power spectra, that the nonlinear perturbations of order 1, which can agree with Planck. Other bounce models, some bounce models are giving nonlinear perturbations of order 10. And this gives much too large a non-Gaussian prediction, which rules out the models. So this is one way to distinguish between the models. You have to be able to distinguish between the models. Otherwise, you're just fitting data, and you've got to falsify one model against the other. This is how physics is done. Okay. So, conclusions. Our VSM models solve horizon flatness problems. It can account for the observed fluctuations in CMB as stretched super horizon quantum fluctuations. They're almost scale invariant, adiabatic, and Gaussian. It can also stretch relic gravitational wavelengths to an observable size in CMB. And these are the predictions for the tilts. The NT is red. The And the ratio here is close to the self-consistency condition for inflation. This is the only model independent result from inflation, that ratio. Since the ordered phase and the spontaneous symmetry breaking of Lorentzian waves is much lower entropy than the symmetry restore and disordered phase, and due to the existence of a domain determined by the direction of this VEV, a natural explanation is given for the cosmological arrow of time and the origin of the second law of thermodynamics. This was my original paper from 1993. The ordered state of entropy in the symmetry broken phase with C greater than C naught becomes a state of high entropy in the symmetry restored disordered phase with C equals C naught. I always found this an interesting explanation for the arrow of time and the second law of thermodynamics. The spontaneous symmetry breaking of the gravitational vacuum leads to this manifold. So the VEV here points in a chosen direction of time to break the symmetry of the vacuum, creating an arrow of time. So for me, my power spectral results are not sensitive to the shape of the potential V. The flatness problem solution produces a uniformity as the universe expands, avoiding the non-uniformity generated by chaotic eternal inflation. I don't have all this problem with different pockets of space-time not inflating fast enough, etc. So I'm not led into a multiverse. Okay, so this is the bottom line. A measurement of the tensor spectral index NT is needed to verify inflation models. The VSO model, or any other competing model of early universe cosmology. But this is a very difficult thing to measure because you're doing nanoKelvin temperature measurements. And to get R is hard enough, but to get the tilt spectral index is going to be very difficult. Until we do that, don't believe any of these models. Because none of them are falsified or verified. It's not easy to do this.
They can be falsifiable if they're internally stable, or they're not embeddable in the full theory.
The only thing that can falsify them additionally to this is the nonlinear perturbation calculation, how much non-Gaussianity there is, okay? And this is already ruled out several models. Bounce models have been ruled out, by the way. The ekpyrotic model of Neil has a very definite prediction that they've stuck to since 2001. As the model cyclically approaches t equal to zero to get the bounce, in the ekpyrotic model, the matter density is small, it's almost zero. The gravitational wave amplitude that you're trying to generate near t equals zero is proportional to the density. So if the density is very small, you never see relic gravitational waves. That's the prediction. This is good. This is a good model because you can falsify it. Okay? In the case of inflation, and myself, VSL, it predicts that you can get gravitational wave amplitude, but you know it could be less than bicep 2 or much less than, or it could be. It's not. You need to calculate. You need to measure the tensor tilt, and once we have that, then everything begins to get sorted out. Apropos, of course, the size of the non-Gaussianity. Thank you. So I'm the chair. Do you have any questions? It's the same as the Higgs mass, Higgs mechanism in the standard model.
No, I thought you said you had to have a violation of NAC to make this work. Did I understand that right, or was I wrong?
It just goes the same way. You choose a gauge where you have a time-like unit vector. Same as you have a time-like scalar component. Yeah. Sorry, what is your question? Sorry.
Right. So unless I misunderstood, tell me if I did. Mm-hmm. You need a violation of net to make this work. And I assume that's got to be coming from this W potential, and you're giving it some tachyonic.
You need to do to violate what?
The null energy condition. Is that true or not true?
You need to produce a preferred time to make C big, so that different observers see different values of C. Okay? You can't stick with special relativity strictly. You've got to violate Lorentz invariance.
I'm not going to get an answer. I've asked twice.
But I think the null energy condition becomes.
Oh, the null energy condition. No, no, sorry. Inflation violates the null energy condition. H dot is less than zero. Yeah.
Inflation doesn't.
If you want a red tilt for NT, you have to violate the null energy condition. H dot has to be less than zero. So for me, I don't think that's the case. I don't think I violate the null energy conditions. H dot is positive. Yeah. It's not. I'm not violating the positive energy conditions. We can talk about this later. Your question is, do I violate the positive energy conditions?
I thought I saw a previous slide, like two slides ago, you said you had to violate NEC in order to make this consistent with observation.
Oh, no, that was inflation, not me. I said the self-consistency condition for single field inflation, R over NT is minus 8, is only obtained when H dot is less than 0. This is, read the papers.
H dot is positive instead of.
No, this is an established. So. However, for me, that's not true. My R over NT equal to minus 5 does not depend on having violated the null energy condition.
So, as I understand it, what you're doing is you're using a very early phase to have the speed of light, speed of gravitational waves extremely large, which allows you to stretch them. Mm-hmm. Way beyond the horizon that you're going to get once you get a phase transition to a normal speed of light. But during that early phase, you have you've broken the Lorentz invariance. You have not just a preferred time-like direction, but actually a preferred magnitude. So you're.
Yeah.
You're
so I'm assuming that FRW is the same as global, same as the local. It's an assumption.
Okay. So. The other part of it is that you're assuming, you know, still quite early, that you can apply FRW assuming a perfect fluid, the standard.
Yeah, standard FRW.
Standard FRW. It seems like a bit of a stretch to suggest that the fields, the matter during that early part of the stage, either during or the after inflation, it can't be treated as a perfect fluid, which is in thermodynamic everything.
That's what you do in inflation.
Yeah.
Inflation, the Mexican habit, the false vacuum inflation, is all classical. It's not quantum. You even, if R is 0.2, there are papers showing that you have to go to 10 times the Planck energy for phi. Magnitude of phi, the inflaton, to get enough slow roll. So you're way transplanking with classical physics. This is why I started off by saying it takes a certain amount of hubris to think that we can explain what's happening at 10 to the minus 40 seconds after the Big Bang. But we do. I'm just joining in the fun.
Like good times. Calculate